Hello and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, your number one comics podcast on AIPTcomics.com, which is the new main URL for AIPT. I'm your co-host, David Brook, and with me is...
Hello, my name is Forrest with two R's, and I am excited to talk about comics this week, especially because they might be over next week.
Yes, might be, probably, but comics will not end. They will prevail. And you're going to get a firsthand word on that from Steve Orlando, who's on the show today to talk all things comics, but also his upcoming series, Killaman at Aftershocks Comics, which comes out in June. Darkhold, which is his first Marvel book. There's a Wonder Woman question in there. There's a Martian Manhunter question in there. Yeah, but Steve also talks a little bit about the comic industry and where we're at right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he's hopeful, just like we are. Just like we are.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I didn't mean to be a little dour. I was, saying that facetiously or in jest. We have a lot of news to talk about this
yeah.
week with regards to things that are going on. I'm sure everyone in the world, all of our listeners, is feeling the strains of this. But to put a word in real quick, to editorialize really quickly.
Yeah.
Continue doing the show every week.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we don't know what the next week or especially the week after that looks like for comics. It's possible that we may pivot to just doing interviews or a kind of book club style podcast where I have a big stack of things I've been meaning to read or reread. We did deep dives on Hawks and Pox before. I especially love doing footnotes and reader's notes and all sorts of stuff. Dave here is a perfect co-host for those kinds of discussions too.
Oh, thank
and
you.
And so I hope y'all will keep checking in. We're going to cover as much news as possible. We just don't know what that looks like for the foreseeable future.
Right. We usually review comics, the newest comics, but we will continue recapping the news to keep you up to date on what's going on.
Yep.
So yeah, the pandemic has hit, and it's hitting harder and harder in America, especially. It coincides with our top news of the week, which is Diamond Comics distributors have halted all comics shipments until further notice. There is absolutely no reason why they would know when they could pick up again, because things seem to be getting worse with the pandemic. This came as a shock for a lot of people, in part because they didn't even tell comic shops the news first.
Yeah. Which is, I have some thoughts about that. I don't know. I think that this is really going to expose that having a singular distributor is a bad idea.
Yeah, that was one of the first thoughts I had. Like, this is basically a monopoly, right? Every comic publisher, pretty much every comic publisher,
pretty much everyone,
TKO,
yeah.
requires them to put out their comics across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're not. They're simply, I mean, Diamond doesn't even publish, like, print the books. They just ship the books. But they have a system that works, and it's in place, and it's been working for a while. As the comics manager and content manager at AIPT, I was waiting for all these publishers to come out and say, okay, we're going to do this now. We're going to do X now. We're going to...
I think that they were surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were all sort of playing it by ear, not knowing what to do.
And even reporting was kind of all over the place, right? Like, Diamond released a statement saying, we have books until March 25th. But then actually further reporting from especially Newsarama said, it's going to be the books that would come out April 8th that will be the last shipment, which maybe...
Yeah.
Diamond's not being very clear and very communicative. Maybe they meant we got our last books into the warehouse today. I don't know what any of this looks like.
Yeah, and it took a day or two for like Dynamite to... I had to reach out to them and they were like, yeah, we're not going to go digital. We're just going to wait. Mm-hmm. And Dark Horse as well came out. And then finally Marvel came out and said they're working on a larger scale plan.
Right, which is very vague. Almost as vague as Diamond.
Yeah, very vague. I mean, it gave me some hope because it's like, okay, well, they're trying to figure this out because, you know, there are reports out there that this pandemic could continue raging on for months. And a lot of these companies, especially the smaller companies, cannot exist without any income for months.
Right, yeah. This is heavy news. I think we're going to have heavy news for a couple weeks, and that's unfortunate, but it's also our job to be fair and unbiased and report the news about comics that are coming out. I think that the truth of the matter is that there are comic stores that will never open again.
Right, yeah, there's a lot of... I mean, brick and mortar, they can't pay their rent. What's going to happen?
Right.
You can't feed your children. What are you going to... You're going to have to figure out a way to feed your children. And then what happens when the stores can open again and however long from now?
And it's definitely going to expose, like I mentioned before, and you're alluding to, problems with having only Diamond, problems with publishers not being in clear communication with each other or with Diamond or with LCSs. There's going to be, and there already is, it seems like, a communication breakdown. But Steve Orlando says later in the show, a fantastic uncensored interview, by the way, that he thinks it's going to also expose the strengths of the comics industry, that they're really going to be able to narrow down on the things that are working for them. I agree that we are going to come stronger out of this. And we've already seen some publishers finding plans for that, being creative under these pressures, right? AWA, the new Artists, Writers, and Artisans publisher, they're moving all their books online immediately.
Which is what I thought Marvel would do, but they haven't pulled that trigger yet. They could, but they haven't.
DC wrote a letter to freelancers saying that, you know, work will be continuing for now. We're thinking of you and the challenges during the current crisis. I want to stress that DC is fully open for business. Our editorial teams and support staff are working remotely for the foreseeable future. That is not interacting or interfering with day-to-day operations. So it seems like DC also has some sort of plan in place, similar to Marvel, vague as it may be. And that's Marvel's quote-unquote larger-scale plan. Mm-hmm. And then you have publishers like Dark Horse. They're reducing their line. They're cutting their line down to 90% or something, I think they said.
Yeah.
Offering full returnability. And they are taking the weird angle of not releasing any new books digitally until direct distribution continues. So that... I think that that is in an effort to support LCSs.
Right.
Which I appreciate. Like, it gives them some sort of exclusivity. I think that that maybe will work. But I want to pivot real quick to the TKO one.
Yeah.
Where they're offering 50% of their profits from digital comics to LCSs directly. The same cut that LCSs would normally get under their model. That, I think, is objectively a better model, a better offer for readers and editors than what Dark Horse is saying. But I don't know. What do you think?
I was hoping Marvel would pull something like this. Yeah. I mean, they're Marvel and DC, because they're the two biggest.
Well, I mean, and Disney and AT&T are backing them, right?
right. Yeah, they have the money. They have the cash flow to actually prop up these LCSs for now. I mean, one of the reasons why this is such fascinating news to me is it's not just business, it's political.
Absolutely.
And I think there are publishers out there making decisions because they may or may not be in support of LCSs and how the system works now.
Right.
And I mean, obviously, I'm getting in a bit into a conspiracy theory there. I'm not accusing anyone of anything.
Well,
but
if
like,
you want to go full conspiracy theory, I'll tell you my conspiracy theory real quick.
Sure.
There will be an irrevocable, never to be changed marriage of Marvel's other businesses with the comics industry now.
How do you mean?
Kevin Feige is their, director of creative or whatever?
Yeah.
To save Marvel Comics, which is their IP farmhouse, they are going to marry it to the movies and all other tie-in stuff so fucking hard that we will never, ever see separate publications or offices inside Marvel ever again.
Interesting theory. I just thought of your other theory that Neil Gaiman's coming back and maybe he's not now.
Maybe he was like, I'm good.
I'll just wait this one out.
I like
books. That could be. I mean, it makes sense to have that cohesion and that synergy, which corporations tend to
and
like
the cash flow.
That word.
Like we're talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
One other thing of Valiant is they're not publishing books either, but they're trying to keep fan interest up with this new initiative called Valiant Hero of the Week. They'll be giving out giveaways. They'll be giving out PDFs. I'm not sure exactly if that means it's a comic or if it's like
I think
a,
it is a
character profile.
PDF featuring whatever hero of the week. So I think it is a comic issue. It's probably, you know, like Dennis Hopeless Hallam's first EXO Man of War or something.
Or a couple of the first few pages or something.
Right. To keep people interested. I think that that's really interesting. I like that.
It's trying to keep us positive, right? And keep us like uplifted.
Yeah, and also to take the opportunity to get people invested into new stuff.
True.
And so that's really cool. I think that energy is probably coming from like they just promoted a bunch of editors, including like Heather Antos.
Right.
People that really care about comics and have really, really interesting ideas. And so I think that we're going to see Valiant do some really interesting stuff. As compared to former Valiant employees, Dark Horse's, or not Dark Horse, I'm sorry, excuse me, Bad Idea, is dead in the water.
Yeah, they're in trouble. Their whole IP is built on the LCSs out there. Although I don't think they're shipping till May, right? Was that right?
Right, but I think that every estimate says that we're going to be in our homes for 6 to 12 months.
Right.
So.
So they are going to either have to go, okay, just kidding, digitals is on.
Right.
Or they're done, right? They can't pull this off.
And then we pivot to the industry that is going to be totally fine.
Yes.
Per all reports, which is manga.
Because they don't go through Diamond,
right. And again, that's going to be something that really exposes the strengths and the weaknesses of these different publishers and their distribution models. Viz was like, hey, we're fine. We use Simon & Schuster and some other smaller distributors. You're still going to be able to get your manga online to your mailbox and in stores as they're available. And Kodansha said the same.
Yeah, they have this new Is Neo online platform.
And they're still also able to distribute, as far as I know. So, and they're also saying that our release schedules haven't changed. So we're 2 or 3 weeks out from me getting caught up on Naruto and One Piece.
Right. It's an opportunity for manga to potentially get a bigger audience.
Right. And unfortunately, we already have some friends of the show doing Queering the Guillotine, a fantastic queer read of manga. And we can't trounce on their IP, so I don't know what we're going to do, Dave.
Well, you know, something that kind of struck me, also DC came out and said they're going to release Gotham High in bookstores. And it made me wonder, like, but, you know, if there's a lockdown or, you know, a quarantine in most of America, the bookstores are still closed.
Yes, but things like Barnes & Noble are owned by Amazon.
Barnes & Noble's owned by Amazon?
Aren't they?
I don't know. I don't.
I think that they are.
Dear Lord. I'm pretty sure. They own all of the online book selling.
But, or there was an idea that Amazon was going to buy Barnes & Noble, which will probably happen now. More established bookstores like that, and also independent bookstores, they have solider distribution models than comics. Comics are a boutique industry. They're really reliant on, like, hand-to-hand sales.
Yep.
Coming in, dropping in, and you're coming in for your Batman book, but you also get sold, I don't fucking know, Redneck or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
But books aren't necessarily the same, and bookstores and book distribution is not necessarily the same. Every Barnes & Noble also happens to be a Funko store now.
Ooh, I didn't know that either.
But they have a solider model, one that has lasted a very, very long time. RIP Borders, of course. It's going to be different for them.
It won't be different for J.J. Abrams, because he'll never put out his Spider-Man comic. So anyway.
So the thing about this is, like, E3, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were already having tons of problems this year.
Right.
Like, Sony pulled out. Microsoft was like, we're going to be there, but off-site. Jeff Keighley, I Am 8-Bit, a bunch of other things published or pulled out. And then E3 was like, we are totally canceling because of COVID-19, of course.
Right, wink, wink.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, right? And that's how I feel about this 20 weeks delayed Spider-Man book.
It's crazy.
And this is, of course, the Abrams and Sarah Pacelli book. They are totally leaning into it.
You've said this on a previous show. They should just freaking release the trade.
They should, right? I think like, now they're like, this book's never going to come out now.
It's their doomsday clock, basically, right. At this point.
Yeah, it is. And it just happens to be coinciding with, a global health crisis. But I laughed out loud at that announcement that they were pushing it back even further, because I was like, well, that's not even the problem with this book.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, they should be rushing it, because no one cares anyway.
Right, yeah.
And it's got problems narratively.
The series finale was originally scheduled for January 29th,
mm-hmm.
April 15th, and now May 27th. And they're kind of saying, maybe.
Right, yeah, I mean,
I don't know. You would fucking think that everyone's at home, just finish the book.
Yeah, exactly. JJ and Henry can have some good father-son time and write it out. Finish the scripts.
Maybe they don't have access to the interns that are actually writing it.
Oh, that's a knock.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. We're going to end the news this week with some positive information.
Cool.
Yeah, so Qbert School, which has been around since, I wrote the article, 1976, Joe Qbert started the school. They are offering online courses for the very first time to anyone. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty affordable at $175 each. There's a couple, there's one for screenwriting or comic book writing. There's one for drawing. There's a couple courses. If you go to aptcomics.com, there's like a link actually that can take you there to see what you can sign up for. It starts April 15th. I mean, it's a renowned school. There's a lot of creators that have gone through here, like Amanda Connor.
A ton of Qbert School alum are Eisner winners.
Yeah. Lee Weeks. There's just, it goes on and on. This is a little hope. This is, it gives me a little hope.
Totally. Because, I think, you know, when people are at home, like I was saying, they do have more time for creative pursuits. And I'm not pushing the narrative that productivity is paramount under a pandemic, right? Like, if you need to take a break and walk the fuck away from your desk because you need to deal with your personal life or because you feel you can't be creative under these stresses, that makes sense. But other people also find value or a little bit of hopefulness and peace in having something to work on.
Mm-hmm.
And going back and learning the basics or learning the basics for the first time, like the Qbert School is promoting, is really great. And I think that we are going to have great comics and great writers and artists and stuff that come out of this once it's all said and done.
And more babies, like you said last week.
Yeah, I can't. Yes. And we're going to put them straight into the Qbert School as well.
We're going to get more babies and more babies that can draw and write comics.
You know, one time I went to Notre Dame for a work trip and they have underground tunnels that connect every building.
Ooh, yeah.
It's very cool. They all have like polished hardwood floors and stuff. And I was thinking, at some point, are we just going to start tunneling to like our neighbor's house or the grocery store? I know it's not airborne, but at some point we're going to have a really cool like nationwide network of tunnels, right?
I should hope. I mean, MIT has the same. Yeah, right. You're right. Like all the colleges just need to get together and figure out the tunnel system to get to each other.
Right. Including the Qbert School.
Including the Qbert School. Well, in our next segment, anniversary issues. Mm-hmm. These are coming out more and more. I think I asked you before the show, they started in what, 2015?
I mean, I was reading an article that indicated there was a really hard lean into them in like the mid-2010s. But of course, like all the way back to the 1970s and stuff, they've been doing historic Batman 50th, 80th issue type things. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times, the content of those books weren't changed. It was just like a special cover.
Right.
With a banner on it or all of the previous covers were on it or something like that. Now we obviously have, you know, things like Action Comics, Detective Comics, Wonder Woman 750, and any other milestone that a publisher can make up. And that has actually different content inside of it.
Right.
Including, but not limited to, the new Dynamite Entertainment, Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, The Death of Nancy Drew number one.
Oh, no.
Which is an anniversary Nancy Drew comic written by Anthony Del Cole, art by Joe Eisma, that celebrates the anniversary of this historic character by seemingly killing her.
Mm-hmm.
This is old hat news. There was a lot of backlash about this when it was announced. I think that it's pretty apparent why that's not a good way to celebrate a character.
Right.
Even if it's a bait and switch, like even if she is alive and
she's in the coffin,
she had to fake her death to expose the killer or something like that. Mm-hmm. Right. Those are all rote storytelling mechanics. And to have the Hardy Boys, two male characters, investigating the death of a young woman that is supposed to be celebrating her is really, really weird, obviously.
Right.
So I wanted to talk about anniversary issues that we do like.
By the way, that Nancy Drew comic was supposed to come out April 1st.
Yeah.
But Dynamite is holding back, so we'll see when she gets to die. Maybe this year.
She will die another day.
She will, just like James Bond. Yeah, so you suggested this segment, which I'm excited about. Because it's sort of an interesting, it's like a niche within the niche market, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah.
You know, we got Joker and Catwoman and Robin all getting theirs this year as well.
And as we know, they sell gangbusters.
And they're always like $10 now, these days. You want me to go first?
I want you to go first.
Great. So, when I was quite young, still in elementary school, maybe? I don't know. Middle school? Anyway, the Spider-Man 30th anniversary comics came out, and this was 1992. They had these hologram covers. Like, they basically just cut out a hologram and glued it to the front of the cover. And they were the coolest thing ever. And first and foremost, I think this is a great way to celebrate the character, because you're, like, adding value to the book in a new way. You're making it more, like, jump out. Makes it distinct, feel, like, expensive.
Right, yeah.
And, I mean, even at that time, there were more money, but not that much money. And then inside, you've got multiple stories. So it just like today, you have multiple creative teams doing books or doing stories in each issue. And it was three different issues. It was Web of Spider-Man, Spider-Man, and Amazing Spider-Man, which all got hologram covers. I think there might have been another one too. But Tom DeFalco wrote a lot of the stories. And each story kind of did their own thing to celebrate the character, but not necessarily move the story forward for Spider-Man in every story. But in one of those, I can't remember which one it was now, I think it was Amazing. At the end, Spider-Man opens the door and his parents are like, "Peter, oh my God, we're back." And literally every comic book reader was like, "Spider-Man has parents?" And that was just blew my mind at the time. Because, you know, his entire identity is that, you know, Uncle Ben died. He only had Aunt May. Now his parents are back. Story went on for a year and a half. If you don't know, they ended up being like clones from the chameleon. I don't know. It was crazy.
Yeah.
Really convoluted. At this time in Marvel Comics, everything seemed convoluted, like the clone
saga.
It was
improv. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's just keep this going and then we'll
laying the railroad tracks down in front of them. Yep.
Exactly. But in these hologram anniversary issues, they also introduced Spider-Man 2099. There were some fantastic Lizard and Mysterio stories and J.J. Jameson stories. So they were kind of celebrating some of the most iconic villains as well. So in a lot of ways, they felt important because they were reminding us of why Spider-Man's so great. And on another level, they were progressing the story ever so much so that you'd be tied in to keep buying the books. So I kind of miss these hologram covers. And I loved the idea of like making it feel extra special. They did that again later, a couple years ago, with like those like tin kind of covers. There's like a flashy metal that they used. But
Foil covers.
Foil covers. So yeah, there was just like really good celebration of the character, even if they were kind of some of the stories within were kind of throwaway.
Mm-hmm.
But those would be my favorites.
So I thought about this long and hard. And I do like those kinds of things, right? Mm-hmm. A celebration of one individual character is really neat, especially when it's deserved. Obviously, like Wonder Woman, Batman, Spider-Man, those characters deserve that sort of celebration, and they've affected a lot of people. And you have the opportunity to have a lot of artists and writers doing their take on it, which is really cool. Like, I think it's the Ellis, Becky Cloonan Batman story in Detective Comics. I thought that was really cool because that's two individual creators working on something that I really like, and they're separated kind of by artistic generations. And that's neat, right? And the more I thought about it, I also like when they do an anniversary issue that's just a collection of all the one-shots, because those are like unique stories. Silver Surfer in particular has some of the best one-shots of all time. But I kind of think that like Marvel Comics 1000 is my ideal anniversary issue.
Okay.
And we dumped on that a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's so like plain faced. They made up a number 1000, right? To sell.
Yeah.
To sell. But it gives you a unique snapshot of all these different places in the Marvel universe. It is kind of weird that like Spider-Man and Captain America got multiple pages out of that project. But again, they're weighted to be important. Does that make sense? And the thing that really cinches that for me is that it's not like when I read Detective Comics, what was that issue? Was that also 1000?
It was.
When I read Detective Comics 1000, I was like, yeah, all right, it's Batman. I get Batman. This is a celebration of the character. It's everything distilled down to what he is. But it didn't necessarily hit me the same way that Marvel Comics 1000 did, which is to say that there's nothing about what's next in that issue.
Yeah.
Marvel Comics 1000 is tied together by this narrative that says And all of these people, the entire Marvel Universe, is about to be affected by this new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a powerful way of telling a story, I think. Like, even if it is fabricated, or even if it feels fake, like, I still want to know what happens next.
Right.
Even if it's the same plot beat that we've done before, I want that. The same way that Incoming number one ends, right? And so I really like that, because they found this perfect tightrope between, here's all the characters you like and why you like them. Donny Cates writes the hell out of Spider-Man, right? Al Ewing writes the hell out of the Hulk. But also here's what's new for them, or what's coming. And as a publisher, I appreciate that kind of transparency, and I appreciate the faith in the readers too.
It's sort of like rising tides
raises all totally, ships. Right? Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Detective Comics had a lead into that Arkham Knight story, but it was so, like, but just slapped on.
Right, it's so slapped on, whereas Marvel felt unified around that idea.
The other problem is the Arkham Knight story, it only lasted a couple issues, and that was it. It was over, and then Tomasi moved on. And it didn't matter. It doesn't matter today. Whereas this book still feels like it matters. And also, it was a really good lead-in to a ton of stories that they're telling.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And so while I appreciate, you know, the gimmick covers or the hardbound collections and all that stuff, what I really, at the end of the day, want is more content.
Yeah.
And more cohesive content. And I think that's what 1000 really succeeded at. I don't know if we're ever going to see CB's 1 million issue idea that he totes. Especially under the current circumstances. But I think that they did a surprisingly good job of making Marvel Comics 1000 feel important.
Yeah, Tom Brevoort, I think I actually reviewed this issue, and I mentioned, like, he should be given accolades, because to pull off...
to piece it all together,
there's so many creative teams that were involved. Like, God, that must have been months of work just to organize it.
So that's where I'm coming from. I think it's a hell of a lot better than killing the main character of a book. Or, you know, whatever's going on there.
Right. Yeah, hopefully we get these other anniversary issues so we can analyze them on this very show.
Yeah, and even for you, the idea of, like, having a comic that you want to put on a shelf or get framed, like, that's cool too, right? So there's totally tons of ways to do it, and I'm excited to see what we're gonna do. Milestones every 5 issues now to save the direct market, and I'm excited to see what they come up with.
What would happen if, like, DC released only, like, 10 issues of Detective Comics 1000, and then they only put it in, like, select comic stores across the nation that they picked arbitrarily?
You know, that sounds like a bad idea.
Yeah, I agree. Moving on to good ideas. In our next segment, Top Books of Last Week, we're going to talk about our favorite comics out last week. And unfortunately, they are the only new comics out for probably at least a week, if not a couple weeks.
Yeah.
So I entered this a bit somber, but hopeful, because there were some great comics out last week.
Yes.
To start the segment, we always mention the top critic and fan pick on comicbookroundup.com. The top critic pick was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles with a 9.5, and the top fan pick was Immortal Hulk number 33 with a 9.7.
Yes. It's no surprise that Immortal Hulk is up here. It is every time it's on the, you know... It's, you know what I mean? It's always going to be there. It's a mainstay. I had a hard time getting that out. But I did see, like, every critic review and every fan review was like, this is the best solo character book I've ever read.
Yeah, it's a iconic issue, too, because it's actually technically Hulk number 750.
Yeah, yeah. The love and the attention and the creativeness that Ewing is pouring into that book is amazing.
Joe Bennett draws some insane, gross stuff, man. Moving on, though, what is your second favorite book of last week?
My second favorite book of last week is Hellions number 1, written by Zeb Wells with art by Steven Segovia. My coworker texted me. I think he picks his comics up or reads them, like, early in the morning on Wednesday, digitally, probably. Mm-hmm. And he texted me and he was like, have you read Hellions yet? You're gonna love it. And I was like, no, I haven't. You had sent it to me, but I hadn't had the chance yet. Work from home is a weird thing. And so sure I was like, all right, well, if Chad says I'm going to like it, I'm going to read it right now. And boy, howdy, he was right. The art is amazing. I think I mentioned this a while ago, but Hickman said that Zeb Wells approached him and said, hey, I want to bring Hellions back. Here's the cast. And Hickman was like, no, why? And Zeb said, let me send you the pitch. So he got the pitch in, and Hickman was like, we're going to keep this book going as long as possible. Yes.
Nice.
That's really cool, right? Like, Zeb had a very specific vision. Steven is the perfect person to bring all of these ridiculous bits, like Sinister and Exodus fighting about how big their shoulder pauldrons are on the funny, council. Yeah. With Mystique sitting there like, oh my fucking god, these guys. They've already fixed Quanon from Fallen Angels. Ride the hell out of Havoc. They ride the hell out of Sinister, who is probably my favorite X-Men villain of all time. I don't count Magneto as a villain. So it just like really gets all of the characters, including like the incredibly difficult to write empath. And it sets up something ostensibly heroic that is very, very sinister. Literally and figuratively, right? And yeah. I think that one of the data pages says that you can't have an Eden without snakes. Mm-hmm. And I bet you that was like the top line on that pitch document. Because I was like, fuck yes.
Yeah.
I'm very excited by it. I thought it was pitch perfect. It's probably my favorite number one Dawn of X book.
Ooh, interesting. That could be a segment for next week. I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but before I do, my second favorite comic of the week was Justice League Dark number 21 by Rem V, James Tynion, and Alvaro Martinez. This is the second part of a obviously multi-part story arc, but the first part, issue 20, was good. This really ramped things up for me, and it gets dark, it's twisted, it's horror, it's well-done horror. It taps into the characters. It brings in Animal Man. It brings in a special villain that we haven't seen in a while in a really powerful way. And it looks amazing. Martinez is, good Lord, keep your eyes on this guy. He's going to be like drawing event books within 5 years. Mm. There are two or three full page splashes that blew me away. There's one that I actually saw on Reddit this morning that's making the rounds where Wonder Woman, it's a full page splash of like a staircase. You see her at the top, and then the next steps, a few steps down, a few steps down, and it's like pulling the action from top left to bottom right as she piles through all these mushroom zombie people and like beats them all up in a certain way, but keeps them alive at the same time. It's just so dynamic, and it keeps your eye moving in through the action. And that's just one of a couple of very impressive pages in this single issue. It's a book that. I anyone who buys it is going to be like, yep, that was definitely worth $3.99. I probably would have paid $7.99 for it. Mm. It's just so good. And I think Ram V is the main writer because his name comes first. And you can kind of get that vibe from the scripting too. And as you know from his Vault series, these Savage Shores, just very like probing, and it draws you in, and you're getting that from this, but in a superhero comic, which you don't see all the time.
That is on my short list of things that I want to catch up on. Especially if new books stop coming out every week.
The series itself.
Yeah, I read the first 10 or 15 of Justice League Dark. And I was like, it's kind of grating on me that it's a Wonder Woman story.
Oh, true.
But
yeah. Her magic.
Right. But, you know, it's important to have a central character or a viewpoint. I'm a sucker for a well-written Swamp Thing. So.
Yep. Moving on, though, what is your favorite book of last week?
This should be no surprise. Especially given the interview that we had with the authors, Zach Thompson and Emily Horn. My favorite book of last week is No One's Rose number 1 from Vault Comics. It's such a compassionate, hopeful, and yet stark and realistic look at what's happening to our planet through the lens of really high, intricate, but also realistic sci-fi. that really stuck with me, especially hearing Zach and Emily talk, as we did with them a couple weeks ago, about what they wanted to get across with the book. It felt very relevant and timely. I liked that they were trying to write a message for younger people, and that, as I just said, it's important to have central characters, right? I love that the central characters in this book are younger people trying to change the circumstances of their weird agrarian bubble life surrounded by this massive wasteland, and that it almost feels more utopic than it does dystopian. You can tell that a lot of philosophical as well as like biological and technological research went into this, but the book never feels like it's smarter than you or that it's looking down at you, because it uses these main characters, a brother and sister in particular, as a lens for this strange new world. I kind of love everything the Vault is putting out right now, but some of those things I find just like being a fantastic delivery of a specific idea. Like, the plot is a great horror comic, but it's not as poignant as something like No One's Rose is. And I think that Zach and Emily, and also the artist, Alberto Albuquerque, put a lot of thought into. It blends this fantastic world of sci-fi and high fantasy and stuff seamlessly and with urgency, I think. I cared about the characters immediately. I liked being able to understand their slang in context rather than having some sort of exposition dump. It's just really, really delicate world building that it doesn't necessarily feel like an issue comic. Like, you don't walk away feeling like you read a PETA ad or something like that. You know what I mean? But at the same time,
it's not preachy.
It feels so important. Right.
Right, right, right.
And that's an almost impossible needle to thread.
For sure, yeah. You have to be subtle in certain ways. Right.
And then knowing how fantastic Zach is at pulling the horror out of mundane things. Zach and I, for the record, have the same taste in, like, everything. So when he says that his favorite author or one of his favorite authors is Jeff Vandermeer, you could sell a comic to me based on that.
Right, for sure.
And so I'm really, really excited about where they take it, how they explore these cultures, and how they explore how we as real people could get to this point and why it's a good thing, not necessarily a bad thing. Even though you have to take the bad with the good, right?
Right, we're always evolving in a sense. When they were on the show a couple of weeks ago, I highly recommend you guys check that interview out, by the way. That science Bible they were talking about they made, like, that just got me so hyped for the series.
Right. Yeah.
The level of thought going into the science and the reality of this, obviously it's a futuristic world, but there's so much reality weaved into it that it could be real. That's fascinating.
And I really feel like, for the record, that a lot of the times books with two writers don't work for me. Because I'm like, oh shit, this is such and such's voice, and this is the other person's voice. But Zach supersedes that so often. And he and Emily, as they alluded to, through their research and through their singular vision for it, it was originally a novel, I guess. They've really created this cohesive image and language that the world lives in. And that's so satisfying to read.
For sure. Check it out, guys. So I picked Hellions by Zeb Wells and Steven Segovia. Yeah. Straight up, like, I was not expecting this to be as good as it was. I was actually going in with low expectations because team fatigue. I think there are too many team books out there. And I was like, why do we need this book with these misfits, these misfit toys? And this book does an exceptional job, especially for a superhero comic, to give us the reasons why it needs to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And you touched on that a little bit with the snakes in Eden thing. There are some great data pages in there that really inform us of why this team needs to exist and how if you slap together these chaotic and violent characters who have, you know, some terrible past, a lot of them are villains, if not all of them, why would you make a team and what would they do? And by the very end of the issue, you're like, oh, okay, now I get it. You enter a chaos element, a chaos weapon, for special types of enemies or locations to fight enemies. And that is really exciting to me. So Wells totally just got me on board with the concept of the team. Then he just perfectly introduces every single character. I feel like the book was extra large. Was it more than 20 pages?
I think that all of the first issues have been slightly above 20, right? Usually, right? Yeah.
Yeah, because I was just astounded by how well balanced each character's introduction was. Mm-hmm. And how, I mean, obviously not every character needs as much introduction as some others.
Real quick, I do love that, like, how self-aware the book is. Like, I love that even the quote-unquote bad guys on the council, like Sinister and Exodus and Magneto, were like, but these guys are fucking assholes.
Right. And then, utilizing other characters to inform on the main characters.
Uh-huh.
That was really well done. I loved Cyclops' use in the book too, because he's like, Havoc, my brother.
Yeah, it's like the most I've liked Cyclops in a long time.
Yeah, his if they could pull off this Cyclops in an X-Men movie, I think it would work really well.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then Segovia did an exceptional job. I love reviewing and reading comics as long as I am, because you start to notice names and you're like, oh, they're pretty good. But then, like, after a couple of years, you're like, oh my God, they're really good. Mm-hmm. It's so cool to see them get better and better. And Segovia is getting, he's coming up there as an A-list artist.
There's a panel where Orphan Maker intimidates someone that you wouldn't expect. And I laughed out loud. Whoa. And also, like, the weird psychosexual humor, written and visual between Orphan Maker and Nanny is laugh out loud funny consistently.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, Nanny's so weird. So yeah, that's my top book of the week. I did want to mention Road to Empire really quick. The Kree Skrull War number one. I broke our rule. I reviewed it. Couldn't help it. It's really good. It mixes the history of the Kree and the Skrull. And then also the Meet the Skrulls characters.
Yeah, I wanted to dive into that real quick, because I was worried that they weren't going to be central to the book or to this event, which is like a weird thing to have this very well-written miniseries, maybe overlooked, that obviously seems to tie in perfectly thematically and in narratively into the event. And they hadn't really said anything about it yet. And then I read this and I was like, okay, awesome. Like, they know what they're doing.
For sure.
Robbie Thompson knows what he's doing.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, the balancing act of showing the past and the present was really well done. And then I just reviewed the history of the Marvel Universe, which was drawn by Javier Rodriguez and colored by Alvaro Lopez, with writing by Mark Waid. And they basically just continued on with that format in this comic, with the, because they drew the flashback scenes where we get the history of the Kree and the Skrull. Mm-hmm. So that was a really cool vibe for me, because I'm like, oh my God, we get more history of the Marvel Universe. This is great. So yeah, it's an astounding, I think it might be one of the best intros to an event I've ever read.
I'm even more excited for Empire.
It's just like artistically done too. And just to hype something else Forrest and I are doing, Empire State of Mind is still going on as far as we know.
For the time being, yep.
Anthony Oliveira is going to be our guest, answering your questions on Empire State of Mind next Tuesday. Check that out. I hope the column keeps going, but if comics stop, I'm not sure how long.
We'll just make up what we think's happening in Empire every week. Obviously,
Empire State of Mind, Dave and Forrest solo.
Jay-Z and Alicia Keys are in it.
Marvel has stopped sanctioning this, so now we're just going to write the story ourselves. Anywho, that is the end of Top Books of Last Week. In our next segment, Top Books for next week and Judging by the Cover Jr. are currently
postponed.
But we will be back with more reviewing of some
Maybe
sort.
Maybe we'll start reviewing books.
Yeah, or manga, like you said. Steve Orlando's on with us. He was gracious enough to take some time to answer a few of our questions across different publishers, across his career. Enjoy. Yeah.
Thanks, y'all.
All right, so on with us is Steve Orlando. You know him from Wonder Woman, the upcoming Marvel book Darkhold, Martian Manhunter, of course, the upcoming Aftershock comic Killer Man. Thank you so much for being on the show, Steve.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So to start, can you give us a brief introduction to Killer Man? Forrest and I were able to read the first half. It's really powerful stuff. I wanted to ask, can you give us a brief introduction to Killer Man and why Aftershock felt like the right publisher for this specific story?
Well, Killer Man is a book that's inspired by the sort of the sort of family meets combat sports narratives that you've seen in things like Rocky, you've seen in things like Warrior, you've seen in things like Creed. And what I wanted to do with Kill a Man is do that type of story and deal with and give that type of underdog, go the distance hero for the queer community. You know, and because when I saw Creed, it's one of my favorite movies now. And I was really bold, you know, at least from an outside perspective, that now the, you know, communities of color get to have a hero like Rocky for the blue collar community in the 70s that goes the distance, that fights the fight. And I love that just that sort of timeless method of taking these heavy emotional conflicts and impossible life struggles and summing them up in a physical struggle. You know, in Warrior, you have all of this pent up family anger over this broken family, and it's almost cathartic in a way that in the world of the movie, like it can all play out like an actual fight, and whoever wins. And wouldn't it be great if that's what real life was like? You know, like
yeah.
So I it's bizarre. I think these combat movies and narratives, I should say, are in many ways actually wish fulfillment. Right, Rocky's in you know 40, 50 years ago, his pent up. Blue collar angst about how he's been looked down upon for being Italian American, for not going to school, for being a Shylock. You know, it's great. You know, he can solve all that by having a tangible, concrete goal in the ring. And obviously, that's not what real life is like. But wouldn't it be nice? So, with Kill a Man, we wanted to examine that and deal with being in the closet, deal with this coming out narrative, and all of the conflict that you have with family expectations and self-loathing that. The process a lot of people go through, and do the same thing and say, like, now, you know, we can speak about this in an allegorical sense where he can't have a victory. But I'll say, as we get to the end without spoiling it, what does victory really mean? You know, my favorite Rocky movies are, I mean, in Creed and Rocky, his win is a personal one. Adonis's win is a personal one. Rocky loses in Rocky, but it's never been about beating anyone but himself. And I think that's what those stories are really special. And by the way, like in Rocky Balboa, which, you know, I tend to think that the middle Rockies didn't happen, I shouldn't say that it happened, but it's a different, it's like a superhero there, and there's nothing wrong with that, you know, but they're about different things. The best of those, all of those narratives, whether it's Warrior, whether it's Raging Bull, it doesn't matter. It's all about proving things to yourself. And so that's what we wanted to do with Kill a Man, with the added homage to Emil Griffith, who's this iconic bisexual boxer from the 60s who did kill his opponent in the ring after he was called some slurs in the ring. And, you know, we're storytellers. We want to create as much drama as possible. So when putting this together, I said, okay, well, how well, you know, I love this narrative of Creed, of the son of Apollo Creed getting trained by his best friend or his father's best friend, former enemy, and finding found family across this cultural divide. But how could we make it even more tense? How could we push these characters even further? And so what you have in Kill a Man is basically like if in Creed, if Adonis didn't go to Rocky, but he went to Ivan Drago to get trained because he had no other choice. Because in Xavier Mayne, James Bielli has no other place to go after he's outed as gay himself, the son of the bigot that Xavier Mayne killed in the ring. And so he has to go to the person that killed his father because he has nowhere else to go. And sort of work through that realization that he's hated this guy for so long, but also as he lives true to himself, his father might not be who he thought he was. And so we push that narrative because it's where we can juice the most drama out of these characters. And yeah, when I look at that book, I think it's electric and I'm super excited about how it's coming out.
The title seems very multifaceted and that really hit me. The masculinity part of it. I don't want to give anything away, but yeah. Did it take a while to get to that title?
Well, yes and no. I don't want to misrepresent and act like Phil and I are like some sort of like literary sorcerers here. I mean, we're geniuses, to be clear. But no. So the title actually came from Emil Griffith. In one of his famous quotes is, and I'm paraphrasing this because I'm not looking at Google right now. Yeah. But it's, you know, I kill a man, and people love me. People cheer me, but I love a man, and people say that I should go to hell for that.
Wow. I didn't know that quote. That's amazing.
And so we drew from that because, yeah, it's easy. By the way, even me as like a former redneck from Central New York in the queer community, to be like, yeah, fuck that guy. You beat his ass and killed him. But, like, it's also easy for me to say because I've never killed a person. And it's a much heavier thing, I think, than anyone imagines until they've done it, until they've lived through it, until they've had to look in the eyes of the people that surrounded that person, whether they were shit or not. And so that's what Maine's a lot of what he the books we've read about him is about. It's like, yeah, obviously it's easy to lionize him. And to be clear, like, we're not doing that. But it's much more complex than we think. You know, it's not Darwin. Mm-hmm. And so it's a real person that has died. And so I think it's easy in the modern era to look at these people and be like, yeah, like, you know, you look at these action movies and, I mean, John Wick kills 400 people per movie. But the reality is, so it's easy to be like, yeah, someone called him a fag and he murdered him. And that is very cathartic. However, in the real world, it's much more complex. And so, like, that quote to me is emblematic because it's not as simple as you want it to be. And as you can see in the book, it's not as simple as you want it.
I wanted to put a word of appreciation in for the story as a queer comics reader. We get two kinds of stories. We get the world is so fantastical that their identity doesn't matter. And we get an autobiographical comic that's about their relationship falling apart only. And very little do we get a story that's about something else in their life in equal measure. And obviously queer people have identities outside of being queer. I run a comics podcast. I have a beard, you know, those kinds of things. And I just really appreciate that very much. I just wanted to put that in there.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's what I've always tried to do. Which, I mean, starting with Midnighter, but my stuff, like, I'm not saying one thing or another about the types of stories you're describing because, you know what, they have their place.
Sure, absolutely.
I think when you're especially early in your life, I shouldn't say early in your life, when you're early in your queer life, in your coming out journey, you want those stories that are like, things will be great and I'll find love and people will accept me and all the things. You need those things because things seem so dark when you're all the way on the other side. But at the same time, well, we all know it's not reality. There is no single trait that defines us, and things are not perfect, but they're also not always as completely shitty as things makes it seem. And so that's always been the type of LGBT stories I've tried to write. You know, James, especially in part one, look, he's not an amazing dude. He has a lot of toxic tendencies. He's in the closet. He's an asshole. But guess what? Like, gay assholes exist. No pun intended. like, we're not all angels, and we all have a journey. And there's a lot of my own journey in James's as well. By the way, like my father wasn't murdered in a UFC ring, but his own relationship with masculinity and what being queer means. Is something I went through. You know, I'm from Central New York. I definitely had a lot of suppositions that in my almost 35 years, I've had to work through. And I'm glad I did, by the way, but it's easy to look back and be like, oh, that was gross. Like that thing you thought when you were 18, gross. And I think it's important to show that, yeah, it's not like a light switch. You don't like come out and be like penises and suddenly the world is like, no, like everyone has a journey. And it's important to me. It really heartens me to hear you say that because, yeah, like these characters are going to reach closure. Obviously, it's a closed narrative. Like that's not a spoiler. Story's end. But like it's work. It's work to break your suppositions. It's work to break yourself of your own prejudices and learn that the way that you see the world is not the way that everyone does. And, you know, by the way, like, I'm not saying something crazy here. You only need to look at how many people from when I was single on Grindr had no fats, no femmes, no Asians, and all that shit.
Right.
It's easy to think, even as an adult, there is a, quote, right and wrong type of queer person, but that's horseshit. So, it's important to me to put this character on that journey, and also to buck expectations. And so it really pleases me. Everything you're saying is exciting to me because that's what I go for. also sometimes worry that there's a little bit of an acid edge to my queer content because there's not enough hugging or metaphorical hugging.
Sure.
But you know what? There's lots of people that do hugging better than me. I do punching.
So pivoting a little bit to the process, as we mentioned, Kill a Man is an Aftershock book, but you've also worked for the big, quote unquote, big two. Do you prefer writing for one over the other? How does your process change for an indie story versus a big publisher story?
I mean, I don't prefer one or the other, but it's different. You are delivering a product working for Marvel and DC, and I'm not devaluing it when I say that, but it's quite literally Marvel and DC are work for hire. Your job is to work on things that they own and add value to things that at the end of the day they will still own. And so, I'm a superhero and comics fan. I think it's an honor and a privilege to do that, to be able to put voice to these characters. But working on something that has been around longer than you and will be around long after you is different than building your own world from scratch and telling these finite stories. And there are pluses and minuses to both. So that's why I want to be clear. Like I'm not down talking working on superheroes, but it is different. You know, with the work I've done on Wonder Woman, the work I'm doing on Darkhold, any of the big two work I've done, I'm adding a brick in this huge mosaic that is just going to keep growing. And that is one type of thinking when you're in a creative space versus something like Kill a Man, something like my book Virgil at Image or Crude at Skybound. Here, you're oftentimes still working with a support team, but it's not a mosaic. You're creating a full work of art yourself. The art of superheroes is one that's open-ended. And that can be wonderful in many ways. Like it's an honor to me to have been on Wonder Woman, as I said, because that's a character that will outlive me, not to be grim, but it will. And has been around for 80 years and has saved people's lives. And those things are huge, huge privileges. So I just consider them different. You know, Aftershock specifically is always incredibly supportive creatively. My book Dead King's there. I had a lot of sort of violent queer ideas in that book and violent ideas in general. And also it's a little bit of a farce. Like it's sort of an ode to Mikhail Bulgakov by way of Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim. But at the same time, it's definitely like for Russian literature nerds like me, like one of the characters has a grenade in his testicles, which is like right out of a Bulgakov book. Where one of the characters gets his balls replaced with a dog's balls and starts acting like a dog.
Oh, wow.
So
I don't know that one. Like,
well, anyway, yes, that's into my life. I don't know that one is a frequent response to my literary references, but the point being, no matter how I'm like, I'm going to push it in this way. Like Aftershock is supportive creatively. So with a book like Kill a Man, where I was like, this is going to be exactly what I want it to be. You know, I can't be at a publisher where, again, and not to with certain content requirements that are not good or bad. It's simply what they are. I would never want a publisher to not be what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Also couldn't have done this book at a publisher where I can't do a book that is as raw and true as Kill a Man. You know, right. I have to put out content that I don't know how brusque you want me to be on this podcast, but like if I'm going to do a book about UFC and mixed martial arts, which is pretty toxic and pretty homophobic,
mm-hmm.
and also engage the truths of the queer community in a way that hasn't been shown to a readership that is mixed and is going to have a lot of straight people in it before, like I need it to be true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to see Maine and Belly talk about the mistakes they made when they were first hooking up with people, because there is no gay sex education. There's no one there's no one to tell you that you need lube or you will be in pain. There's no one to tell you about hygiene. Like it's an opportunity with these books, even if it's true and shocking to some people who have never been in the community, to speak truth and to be bold. And so like after having done Dead Kings, where I was like, wow, you let me go weird and literary. I had no question that they would be supportive with Kill a Man. And it has been the case. You know, like I hope that when people read the books from outside the queer community and they learn things, maybe they'll be surprised at first, but I hope that they learn things about our world. Because, you know, at the same time, like that's how you learn to relate, and that's how you learn to understand, and that's how you learn to sort of bridge those gaps. So
yeah,
Aftershock creatively is a company where I knew we could do that. I knew that we could show what we want to show and have the trust to know that we're not being exploitative. We are maybe being shocking, but it's an effort of being subversive and being true.
Right. You know? Yeah. It's getting to the truth of it. Yeah, for sure.
Look, like there had never been a douche on TV until Looking. Okay. Like people thought that gay sex just happened through magic. So, I'm being sarcastic because it's my normal mode of interaction, but that stuff is also important because people have to learn and people have to know. It's and for a young queer readership, literally people have to learn because
right.
there
right.
being no mentorship in mainstream education is real. You know? I mean, look, I'm from Syracuse. Our sex education was like non-existent. And I, like, this is an embarrassing story, but welcome to the type of content you get when I'm on your podcast.
No, of course. No, go ahead.
I remember watching Seinfeld when I was a kid, and there was this episode where Jerry and Elaine tried to hook up. Maybe they did hook up, and it just didn't work. I don't know. But it smash cuts to them on opposite sides of the bed, okay?
Yeah.
And, like, oh, God, I can't wait for people to listen to. Anyway, I did not know how semen got into a vagina because of being raised in Syracuse.
Oh my
gosh. I thought that Lane sat there
and
Jerry was on the other side of the bed, like she was just like sopping it up. Okay.
I'm trying to imagine that. Yeah.
Like a vacuum. No, it's absurd. Like I'm telling the story because it's absurd.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's how little we knew.
Right.
So like, and so I think that, you know, there's the top line talk of representation and being like, oh, it's good to see yourself. Yes. But it's also good to do a passive service because sometimes like you learn about things for the first time in fiction. You know, I probably learned about condoms from fucking death putting a condom on a banana, not from school.
Right, right.
And so those things are important.
Right, yeah.
Especially in the modern pandemic sense, extremely important. Barrier method for everything, including grocery shopping. Anyway.
Yeah, was it Germany that just passed a $50 billion relief for artists? And they said that, you know, they made the statement that like artists are important, and you're hitting the nail on the head as far as one reason why artists are so important, because they can fill in the gaps for people when like the government or, you know, our parental figures fail us.
I mean, yeah, I mean, to be clear, like I'm not just writing to teach people about
right.
where penis or like that is
right.
not the whole
right,
kind
right,
of micro.
Right.
But I'm happy to help.
You know, you were speaking just a second ago about how, like, you know, creating your own world is one thing, but also, you know, writing in the universe of the big two, you're also kind of taking up the mantle and then carrying it forward as far as you can go. And when I saw in Wonder Woman number 754, you had the invisible starfighter, which I think you tweeted about as well. Did you have to, like, go into, like, back issues to figure out if that has ever been, like, a thing? Or, you know what I mean? Like, did you have to, like, check yourself on that?
Well, I mean, I've read many issues of Wonder Woman,
yeah.
so it's not as though it's never a book where I have to go into back issues on specifically, though I have for other books.
Gotcha.
With the Starfighter, I'll be honest with you, like it was an ode to me of what is some of probably my favorite era of the book, which is when Phil Jimenez was writing and drawing it. And in that period, she had the Invisible Jet was actually a Lanzarian alien shape-shifting craft.
Uh-huh.
So she could make it. She would keep it in her pocket, and she could make it. It could blow up into a jet, but she could also. It was just like a little ball, like a ball of translucent material, and she could make it into a jet. But you could also make it into other things. And so, in that specific thing, I want to do an ode to that. Era when his ship was this alien gift. You know, she saves the Lanzarians, I believe, probably in the previous run, maybe like the Messner-Loebs era, and they give her this. So, and it eventually she gives it up and it becomes the Wonder Dome, which is like an embassy type thing. So that's what I was going for there. And yeah, like I think, you know, the invisible jet needs to be cool.
For sure.
So,
yeah.
And especially because both you had the Lanzarian illusion, but also like her new jet was made by Natasha Irons, who has shape shifting armor that responds to her thoughts. So why wouldn't the jet do the same thing?
Yeah, he took it to the next level.
We hope so.
Yeah.
So pivoting to another thing from your Twitter real quick, Killaman focuses on the careers and relationships of two boxers. But I also happen to know from your social media that you're a big professional wrestling fan.
Well, we updated Killaman to MMA. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's absolutely. So it is an MMA book, which is one of the reasons I'm co-writing with Phil Kennedy Johnson, because he trains MMA in addition to being an awesome dude and great player of the trumpet. But go on. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Thank you. Which professional wrestler would you most want to write a comic for?
Oh, God. For or about?
About, sure.
Man, many of them have fascinating stories. I really think you could do a great book on the life of Bruiser Brody. You could do a great book on the life of Antonio Inoki, who has just had a crazy life. You know, he's still alive. I shouldn't say had, is having. He's an icon. He was easily one of the most influential wrestlers in Japan. He had like a work shoot fight with Muhammad Ali, obviously one of the greatest of all time. And then he started one of the greatest wrestling federations in Japan, New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Yep.
And then also now he's in the Senate. Now he's in government. Like and then he also converted to Islam. So like personally, I find that very fascinating. Like I just think that he's incredibly interesting as a person. I don't know like non research stuff about him. Like we've never met or anything, but I think that he's fascinating. And at the same time, like, I mentioned Brody, just because again, like he was one of those dudes, like Haku, where he was a real life tough guy and people were terrified of him. And he would often, you know, like when you were a promoter, you knew that booking him, he was just going to kind of do what he wanted because we were going to argue with this like 6'4" crazy person. In real life. So I find him fascinating. Obviously Dusty, I think Dusty's the greatest.
Yeah, Dusty. Yeah.
As anyone who follows me on Twitter knows, I secretly, not secretly, but my like underdog favorite is always going to be Bad News Brown. I mean, Bad News Brown called out Andre the Giant and Andre would not fight him, which is crazy. Andre was drunk on a bus and he dropped the N-word, and Bad News said to stop the bus and meet him outside, and Andre would not go outside and fight this guy. So, like, I mean, what other cred do you need?
For sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not into wrestling, but our site has a whole section. We have our own wrestling podcast as well. It's awesome. You guys are so into this stuff. You should, hopefully Boom is listening. Boom Studios. They can get you this book.
Oh, God, yes. Well, it would just be page after page of people... it would all be backstage. Like the book could not be kayfabed at all. That would be my, but anyway, like, so, but there's so much more too, by the way. Like, I mean, I'm fascinated by early era women's wrestling as well. Mm-hmm. What the hell's her name? Bull Nakano would be incredible to write about. She's so many like big time women wrestlers now cite her as an influence, and she was on at WrestleMania, but just it was during a period where no one cared, and yet she is this like iconic Liger as well. Like Liger.
Yes, I love Liger. Sorry,
it's crazy to me that like okay, like yes, it's a benefit being a smaller guy, stature wise. But, like, the fact that Liger and Undertaker are the same age is bananas to me. Undertaker looks like he has to get wheeled out. And then,
right, yeah. Yeah.
And has to get, like, a chondroitin shot just to work. And Liger is essentially working a style that is unchanged at age 55. And now, obviously, he just retired. But and also the storytelling in Japan, I think, is I'm not one of those people like Meltzer that just like comes over Japanese wrestling all the time. Mm-hmm. But what I do think is that their booking is much more even-handed and they have a lot more restraint. Like New Japan is booked in a way where it never seems so unrealistic if there's a surprise win, you know, like what am I thinking of? Like Tomohiro Ishii beat Kenny Omega and he's a mid-card guy. He wasn't booked so weakly where you're like, oh, like I could see it. You know, like they keep everyone strong enough where you're like, oh, if someone just has a bad day, like something shocking can happen. But to be clear, like based on the rank in the card, like Ishii beating Kenny Omega is like fucking Cesaro beating Brock Lesnar, and if that happened, you wouldn't accept it. Fans wouldn't accept it because of how they bury their mid card.
Well, people want the Cesaro push. I don't know about that.
I'm saying from a narrative sense.
Yeah, of course.
Cesaro push. But it's like they would have to rehab him first from an actual kayfabe sense. I mean. Although, to be fair, in WWE, it seems only like the last year's continuity. You know, like they when Braun Strowman debuted, he was choking out Roman like a fucking rag doll in 2 seconds. And then suddenly a year later, Roman was doing infinite spears and whatever. So, but I also think like that's fascinating about Liger is how I got on that because like he had this crazy awesome persona, Kishin Liger. When you finally push him too far, he basically turns into the Murder Hulk. And it's awesome. And he only did it 3 or 4 times in his entire career. And that's what's shocking to me. Like, if this was WWE, that shit would happen every 6 months.
Sure.
And it would become less special. And so the thing about Liger is that he knew how to maintain his character and make it so when he did these things, it really was still special, I would say.
You keep saying Liger, and I keep thinking of Tiger King for some reason, that show.
I did once have a fan scream at me about the difference between a Liger and a Thai Liger once. And so that's why I'm not... And that's why I'm not doing Chase Con in Saratoga anymore.
Thai Liger, that's a different breed? That's interesting. I've never heard of that.
I know, for all I know, dude. Yeah. He was like he also had like an entire 600-page spiral ring notebook with his like handwritten werewolf love story. So like a lot was going on there.
Preparing for this interview, I was actually reading an interview you did with Screen Rant where you said something about villains also work when they are dark reflections of a hero. Then I go and I read The Darkhold synopsis, which talks about, it says, to save them all, the Scarlet Witch must gather the world's greatest heroes and unleash their inner darkness. What is it about inner darkness that appeals to you? Because it seems like that's a reoccurring theme.
Well, that's also a little bit of, shall we say, solicits may not specifically reflect the exact story.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you this. Like, the Darkhold is an homage to sort of In the Mountains of Madness to me.
Oh,
and
cool.
So what it's about in this specific sense is that these characters, in order to confront a villain related to the Darkhold, they have to temper themselves with madness by reading from this book. And in reading it, it changes their reality into these sort of broken, it's like broken Matt Hardy. These versions of themselves where they've taken these paths that they would never ever take. Like, for example, like Wasp is in it, for example, and it's like, you know, if, you know, when she's first fighting with Hank, like if instead of having what happened, like she just fought back and killed him and it broke her and it set her on this different path. So what you're going to see with Darkhold is characters that are tempered with madness and become these mad versions of themselves in order to confront something worse. And to bring it back to your question, though, like I sort of like balked at it being about inner darkness, but maybe it is because it's about the choices that we don't make and how they could have affected us, often which are emotionally pleasing ones that also are easy, you
right,
know, and,
right.
that, mm-hmm. and without thinking of further consequences. And I've written about that a lot, by the way, like the first issue of Wonder Woman that I ever did, 51, is about. She says it, you know, she's challenging Mayfly, this character that tried to kill her. And she says, like, a fight to the death is easy. You know, it's over quickly. A harder fight is one for life because that keeps going. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it fascinates me because we want to, it always seems like these violent solutions and like on some level it seems cathartic. And it can be, but I do think it's easy. And I think that that's fascinating. Like it is much harder to overcome conflict than erase it. You know, often in comics with gruesome murder, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really does that interest me because we so often in life, conversely, because of laws and things like, you know, morals and decency and not all being monsters, we can't take the choices these characters make. So there's almost an allure to that darkness. Like, what if I did just fucking bash my boss's head in after they were condescending for the 500th time? you know, what if I did do X, Y, and Z? And where would that go? And who would I be if I did that? So those things do interest me because, yeah, like, we're a culture that really does celebrate anger and vengeance and things like that. We love stories of someone getting what's coming to them. But I don't know that we really think about what happens to the perpetrators of that vengeance afterwards. Like, that changes you. And there's a reason that we're not still dueling in the streets. Although, give it time. But, like, and so I think that the darkness in people is interesting because it's the mirror of this restraint that we have to show. And I think we look at it and we find it sexy because we can't really act on those things. But at the same time, I don't know if we really considered the long-term effects. And so I think examining that is important because, yeah, like, it's easier being Batman and just being angry and beating people's heads in and dropping them in jail than being Wonder Woman. And
right, finding the right solution,
radically compassionate. Right,
compassion is harder than vengeance.
Right,
but it's less sexy. No one wants, like,
especially in American society.
Yeah, nobody wants to be like, oh, that guy called me a piece of shit, and so I took him to lunch and talked about why. No, they want to be like, that guy called me a piece of shit, so I kicked him in the balls and I dropped a cinder block in his head.
I feel like that's what, like, Fight Club's about too, in a sense. Isn't there a scene where he beats his boss up, too? Or yes. He beats himself up in front of his boss, right? Yeah, that's right.
Well, it's like Mark Miller's entire career. Like, I'm the anti-Mark Miller. There you go. There's your soundbite. Like, I will never write a story that sensationalizes rape. So, there you go.
It sounds like Darkhold is a banger of a first Marvel book because you get to write all these other characters at the same time. But I think Doctor Doom is still a main character. Is he still a main character in the book?
Oh, for sure. Doom and Scarlet Witch are the main characters.
Gotcha. What are some of your favorite Doctor Doom stories?
Doom to me is like, well, first of all, Doom I think is one of the best comic characters, regardless of company. Yeah, hands down. He is an icon, and so the fact that Marvel is willing to let me work with him in my first book is crazy to me, because he's so imperfect. You know, like, if you look at the end of Secret Wars, like, despite his incredible will, his incredible power, it's still so much just about ego. You know, so to answer your question, one of them is Secret Wars, the Ribic and Hickman book.
Yeah.
Because, A, it's got iconic Doom moments. Doom to me is all about, you know, he's facing down the Beyonders. Who would possibly dare face us? I dare. You know, he's like Skeletor. I dare anything.
Yeah.
He's like movie Skeletor, not like, I don't want to be good. I want to be evil. Movie Skeletor. And, but I find that fascinating because in some ways, like, Doom is the ultimate dark mirror of human ingenuity and human will, right? Like, he is still essentially mortal. I'm saying essentially because it's comics.
Yeah.
And yet he will look a god in the face and say, recognize me. Not only recognize me, but bow down, you know, Beyonders. You ain't shit. Power cosmic. I'm going to steal it in Secret Wars. And like it's always Doom. And I think that's fascinating because it's all about his will. And at the same time, for all of his mastery of the world and everything in Secret Wars, it also shows his imperfection because, as the denouement of that book shows you, like, it ends with him finally admitting that Reed Richards is smarter. And that's all.
Mm-hmm.
Because for all of his power, the best he can do is a fucking, like, autocracy.
Right. I love that story.
He is imperfect. At the same time, he's incredibly strong-willed and he's incredibly unrelenting. And, like, I find him fascinating. He is, quote-unquote, a villain, but he's not, like...
It's, you know, shades of gray. He really cares about his people, I think.
And, well, And he will do things that other villains won't. You know, like, in my hypothetical Marvel versus DC crossover, like, if Darkseid tried to conquer the Marvel Universe, Doom would be standing with the heroes. Because, if anything, he thinks that it's his responsibility to control the world, not Darkseid.
Right, right. You know?
Sure.
And he would be insulted that something other than a human would think that it would have power over him. And so, like, I think he's such a unique story driver because he does do things that other heroes won't, you know? Other characters won't. And And at the same time, he's so egotistical that it's almost painful to watch him, right? Like, if you could just get out of your own way. He's like Lex Luthor in that respect. He's like fades away from Lex Luthor. Like, if you could just get your head out of your own ass, it could really change the world, man. Because, yeah, you might be the second smartest person in the world behind Reed Richards, but you're still really fucking smart. And so, yeah, I just find him fascinating. And as a, from a creative standpoint, I mean, a mild spoiler, I guess, like it lets you, there are things that he can, you know, because of his will, there are moments that can only happen with Doom. You know, we reveal our version of the Darkhold in the story, and much like in Lovecraft, if you read it, you go completely mad. You know, like when the Scarlet Witch shows up, she can't read it. Victorious can't read it. And when Doom arrives, but they need to find out what's in the book because that's how they find out about how to beat the villain. And so when Doom arrives, she says, oh, well, you know, no one can, how can you possibly know what you know about the Darkhold? You know, nobody could even open the first page. It would drive anyone mad. And he just sort of laughs and says, oh, anyone but Doom. I read that immediately. I read the second, I got it. And so, you know, of course, Doom is the only person with a will strong enough to read this book that will turn anyone insane except for him.
That's boss.
That's a pretty good case for Doom for my next question, which is your Martian Manhunter series with Riley Rossmo was a deep dive on one of the most overlooked, quote, unquote, main characters at DC. What Marvel character would you like to do the same for?
I mean, is Doom overlooked? I don't think so.
It's been a bit, I feel like.
He's got a really good book by Christopher Cantwell right now.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, he's back in a big way now, but it had been a bit, I think.
Marvel character. Well, actually, one of them is in the book. I love, you know, they've had a run recently, so I don't know. This is not like I'm not being obtuse. I don't know what the plan is, but I love the Inhumans, and I love Black Bolt. That's one of the reasons Black Bolt and Darkhold.
I think that very qualifies.
And I mean, I love Black Bolt is one of my favorite Marvel characters. I love the Inhumans in general. There's an interesting challenge in how you make them unique now between what I, you know, between the Eternals in the movie and the great work that's being done with mutants in Dawn of X. But that said, I just love Black Bolt. I would love a chance to work with him and Medusa because their relationship is unique. And also, I just is, I mean, I'm an idiot and I love Jack Kirby and his design is classic, if not absurd. And his name, his superhero name is Black Bolt and his real name is Blackagar Boltagon. And that's amazing. But I just, his power to me is also like one of those classic, like, monkey's paws type powers, right? Like there's an inherent tragedy. He's incredibly powerful, but the sacrifice is so great that he can, you know, barely communicate with anyone else. It's like Rogue. It's like Rogue, but it's like Kirby Rogue, I guess.
Kirby Rogue, I like that.
Distancing Queen.
That's true. I didn't think of that.
So I love Black Bolt. And I love Angela as well, weirdly, even though she's a newer addition to the Marvel Universe. I'm fascinated when companies integrate outside IP into their lore. Like,
yeah, that's wild.
I mean, DC has been doing that, by the way, for years. I mean, they've been buying companies. Look at Shazam/Captain Marvel. Okay, like, look at when Wildstorm. I mean, I owe my career to them putting Midnight and Apollo in the DC Universe, so... I love the challenge of Angela, and I think that there's a ton of opportunity with her. So hopefully I get a chance to work with her at some point as well, because I love that. I love the character. I love the design. I love the lore that they worked around her, like to sort of connecting it to Thor and Asgard, but sort of not. As my advisor in college was a Milton scholar, so I think that she would hunt me down if I didn't do a book at Marvel about someone who was from heaven. but no, I really like her as well. I mean, I could go on, by the way, like, but we're not going to be here all day. But no. I love those things. I love the Shroud. I mean, like, as I said, it's always a long list with me. I love Terror Inc.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. These all qualify, I think.
When you were little, what did you think you'd be when you grew up?
I'm doing it. Honestly, like, nice. I started breaking into comics when I was 12 years old. So if they don't cancel Comic-Con this year,
Yeah.
This is my 22nd year going in a row.
That's awesome.
Is it? But
it's a grind, isn't it? Any industry is really, but yeah.
But I'm just being facetious. Yeah, but I knew, you know, I started when there were, like many people, I had those times when I was like, I'm going to be a paleontologist. I'm going to be a veterinarian. but it was, you know, soon after I started reading modern comics, because I started reading comics with West Coast Avengers in the 80s, but it was a back issue. I thought I was going to be an artist, and then I realized my art was very bad, a visual artist, I should say, writing his art. But it was soon after that when Superman became electric and sparkly. And I read this editorial about how they put that together and what role the writers played, where I knew I wanted to write comics. And I mean, it was, you know, that year I saved up fucking cans. The deal with my parents was if I could save enough money for my plane ticket, they would pay for the hotel. And I went to Chicago. At that time, it was Wizard World Chicago. Now it's C2E2.
Yeah.
And I went to my first show when I was 12 and started trying to meet people and learn how to write comics. And my books were very bad, but I also, that was the year I met my mentors, Joe Kelly and Steve Siegel. And even though I went to college and worked another job for 10 years, after that almost, I was always working at this. So this is what I have always wanted to do. And as I'd said in the Hollywood Reporter, like, now it's actually mutated. Like, I want to do more than just comics, because you can't only rely on one thing and you can't only stimulate yourself with one type of writing. But I've always thought I'd be a writer. I always wanted to. I always knew it'd be a long hustle. And what that life is always changing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm doing it. And it's been that way since I was 12.
If you believe in that 10,000 hour rule, I mean, you're up there. That's for sure. It's not even writing too, right? It's like networking and all that aspect as well.
It's both. I mean, I've had hundreds of pitches rejected until I didn't. So.
Yeah, I saw that tweet. It's like a underdog story in a sense, isn't it?
Well, it's true though. I mean, my pitch. I started having pitches rejected by Image when I was like a sophomore in high school. So.
I have to say, like, coming off Wonder Woman this week that just came out, Darkhold announced only, 2 weeks ago now, and now with, you know, Diamond Comics distributors saying, you know, we're not going to be printing comics, I kind of feel like you might have one of the most unique perspectives, because you've got, you know, all these positives, and this is happening. Like, what's going through your mind right now with the industry?
We're all worried. Yeah. But at the same time, like, comics are going to be here. I think we'll say this. I think that there's going to be irrevocable change coming from this. But at the same time, I don't think comics are going to go anywhere. I think that we've been on some things about distribution have been on life support for a long time. And now we're not going to be able to rely on those things. So I think you're going to have to see companies become more shrewd and innovate. But that said, as a whole, the medium is not going anywhere. It's going to change, and that change might be painful for a while, but that's why I don't only write comics, and it'll still be here, but I do think it's going to look different. And I, like any of us, are like, oh, well, I mean, hopefully we make it through this period of change personally. And I, you know, I work really fucking hard, so I think that I will, but it's going to be interesting. I think that, you know, a lot of readers know a little bit, but some know more and some don't really worry themselves with it. But a lot of the industry has been running on speculation and collectors. And I think what you're going to see is a real necessity and shift, even if it's going to be hard, to finally key in on what our real reader base is, that actually is reading and liking the characters rather than just buying out of habit or necessity. And I think that is a good moment. It's one we've needed for a long time, rather than just relying on gimmicks to sort of artificially blow up sales. But look, it's going to be hard. And I can't tell you what it's going to look like after, because nobody can. But it'll still be here. And I think it's going to be stronger after, because we will finally really know who's reading the books. But it's going to be a challenge. It's going to be a weird year, no doubt.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we're all kind of just figuring it out as we go. Everything's changing so fast.
Thank you so much, Steve. The last question we have for every guest is, what are you into right now that isn't comics? It could be anything. Movies, games, books, skateboarding, whatever you want.
Not skateboarding. well, the good thing is we have a lot of time for hobbies because we're all stuck inside. What am I into right now? Well, my boyfriend is into gaming, and I was previously not, and so we've been trying to find the right things for us to do together, and we have been playing this game called Ni No Kuni.
Yeah.
Essentially like a Studio Ghibli RPG, and I think it's great. It's adorable, it's lushly animated and constructed, and we try to play it for a couple hours every week. Because I'm still working, obviously. But I really love that. I think it's great. What else is going on? On the TV side, I'm watching the latest season of Castlevania, which is awesome.
Awesome.
And also, like, it's fun, again, for boyfriend to watch it, who never read a Warren Ellis comic, and just for the first time realized that deep Warren Ellis cynicism that has been had a profound effect on my life. And what else is going on? And I'm really excited about Carb Smart Tortillas because I'm also excited about health and fitness. And to find a tortilla with 3 net carbs is better than gold for me. So there, that's a weird answer that few other people will probably give. But I'm very excited.
Those are great answers.
Changing my life, man. I can make street tacos anytime I want now. So it's very exciting.
Those are awesome choices. We've had people pick like whiskey. It's sometimes a surprise, sometimes it isn't. Watchmen was a big pick. A lot of guests were picking for when that show was on. Steve Orlando, thank you so much for being on the show. Darkhold's coming out June. Killer Man's coming out June. Is there anything else you want to plug on the show?
Well, keep an eye out on the DC solicits because I have one or two things that are still not solicited there that I'm very excited about. But I really like I cannot wait for Killer Man to come out. Darkhold and Killer Man are like, you know, I guess I'm in the Marvel phase of my career now, so I'll say it's phase two of my career. Phase two, trademark, Kevin Feige. And, but that said, like, I'm incredibly excited about that book. Will Moss and Sarah Brunstad editing it have been incredible. Kian Tormey is doing the art, and like, he's just incredibly enthusiastic. The pages that I've seen are awesome. And then Killer Man is just like, for people who read Midnighter, for people who've ever read my work, anything I've ever done, like, this is a story that I've been fighting to tell for years. I finally found a home in Aftershock. And like, every time I read it, every time I review a PDF, I'm just like, this is fire. This is the best thing I've done. So please check it out. Like, it's all I'm going to be talking about for a long time because I'm just so fucking happy with it. So I can't say that enough.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on.
It's my pleasure.
Please don't forget to subscribe and review. We cannot overstate how important reviews are, especially on app stores like Apple Podcasts.
And also check out our other podcasts on amptcomics.com. We've got the wrestling podcast. We've got Adventures in Movies, Talking Tauntauns, the Star Wars podcast. But yeah, we here at APT are going to stick with it, even if there isn't any new content, because there is a lot of old content we've never touched upon.